Water. Earth. Fire. Air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased, in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series, Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar. And although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end, and like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexities of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. A year ago, we went and hung out with the gang and podcasted about Avatar, The Last Airbender. And it was great. It was an incredible ride. We visited the Southern Air Temple. We stood with the Northern Water Tribe. And we even drank some tea with Iroh and Ba Sing Se. And finally, we took out Ozai. Well, we just took away his bending. And brought balance back to the world.
Last week, we enjoyed some pro-bending and watched the Equalists escalate their efforts to intimidate the benders in the city. We saw Tarlok begin to retaliate by using the police force to oppress the benders. And Korra and the new team Avatar stepped up to defend human rights and paid the price with their freedom. This week, we're going to be talking about episodes 9 through 12.
Love triangles, courtroom and family drama, heckling at political rallies. Hell yeah, Kin Folklore is going to have adult content. I hope you're ready, because this is a deep one. Anyway. Yeah.
Episode 9. Out of the past. Tarlok, having just kidnapped Korra. Just let that sit for a minute. Tarlok kidnapped the Avatar.
By bloodbending.
This was a heavy transition here.
Yeah.
Blood bends her into a metal cage somewhere in the mountains and leaves her there. Back on Air Temple Island, the phone rings while Tenzin, Pima, and little Milo are sleeping. I love the idea that Milo sleeps in his parents' bed.
Yeah, that's cool.
Milo picks up the phone. His customer service skills are not good.
You better have a good reason to be calling at 6 a.m. in the morning. Who is this?
I'm not mad at him, though. He's not wrong.
I'm not mad either, but my parents would have been pretty upset if I picked up the phone like that. So Tenzin is being summoned to City Hall. When he arrives, Tarlok lies and says that Korra came to his office and they were both attacked by Equalists, who then captured Korra.
He tried to save her, you know, he really did. He tried.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was going to say that Korra beat him up and then ran away, but so this was like slightly less offensive to me, but it's still a horrible lie. Mm-hmm. He mobilizes a police force to find Korra. And when Lynn hears the news over the radio at home, she suits up and immediately busts Team Avatar out of jail so that they can rescue Korra. She is definitely working outside the law.
She took that badge off, too. She suits up and is like, okay, this badge has got to go. I'm about to break some laws. Let's go. It was good.
Stuck in the cage, Korra finally decides that she's got to meditate. And she has a vision and sees 40-year-old Aang speaking with the police chief, Toph Beifong. Aang asks to accompany Toph while she attempts to arrest a criminal named Yakan. Yakan seems like a normal gangster, but Aang says, based on the witnesses' accounts, he's no normal criminal. Meanwhile,
out here calling this grown man Twinkle Toes.
40-year-old man, she's calling him Twinkle Toes. In front of other people. Yeah, he's the Avatar.
Can we stop with the nicknames? She's like, nah, we're not stopping. I love her for that. It's great.
It's hilarious. It's great. So meanwhile, Team Avatar and Lin visit Tenzin, who tells him that he's been trying to find Korra without any luck. Apparently, Naga is also missing, which is, I was alarmed by this because Naga went to the city hall with Korra.
This triggered me because...
Yeah, no, I was definitely
I just instantly thought of Appa in the desert and all that happened to him. And I was like, you guys better not fucking go here. Like, this was like the trauma. I could feel it in my body. I was like, okay,
yeah, no. It was pretty... I was like extremely alarmed for Naga.
Yeah.
Believing Tarlok's story about the Equalists, they decide to revisit the events of Bolin's kidnapping by the Equalists, hoping that they'll, also find the missing police officers. Lin finds a tunnel, and in the tunnel, Asami asks Bolin about, what's going on with Mako and Korra. And I'm like, Asami, can you focus? Like, Korra's missing. Y'all underground in a secret tunnel.
Well, he being mad extra, though. This guy is extra. like he went from, like kind of nonchalant, cool guy to, like, oh, my God, she's missing. We got to go everything. Overturn every rock. We must find her. Like, he was super emo. Like, and she was like, whoa, this is, like, exaggerated. Like, you're supposed to be my man. Like, it's weird.
It's weird. He's definitely being a little bit too attentive. I would have had my antenna up, but I don't think I would have asked this question at this moment. But anyway.
She know Bolin is the weak link when it comes to getting this information. Look what happens. Look what's about to happen.
Well, Bolin immediately spills the tea about the kiss during the tournament. Mm-hmm. And then they're interrupted by a car that drives through the tunnel and reveals a secret door.
They love doors, secret tunnels. They love tunnels. There's a lot of tunnels in this world. Anyway.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, underground recesses and all. It's just, there's a lot of stuff. I was like, they have a lot of places to hide stuff in this city.
You know, that would have actually made some of our fans really happy if there was, like, the freaking, like, nomads showed up inside of the city. I mean, they kind of do, singing, like, somehow they've, like, revamped, like, the next generation of the band. You know what I mean? That would have been great. A little secret tunnel action. Anyway.
So, Lin senses that her police officers are there, that they're being kept in this Equalist prison, but Korra's not among them. She releases the officers and finds that, unfortunately, they've already been stripped of their bending. Mako questions a guard. I mean, talk about being extra.
So extra.
He basically tortures the guard to tell them, like, where's Korra? What happened here? And the guard tells him that they never attacked City Hall, that Tarlok lied, and that the Equalists don't have Korra. As the team realizes that Tarlok deceived them, they are forced to make a hasty escape, and Lin manages to get them out of the tunnel by essentially creating a new tunnel and avoiding dozens of Equalist forces. In the next scene, Korra's vision continues. She sees the trial of Yakan, where the prosecution explains that Yakan has been using the illegal practice of bloodbending. The defense asserts, that's impossible. Bloodbending is only possible during a full moon, and all of these offenses took place outside of a full moon. Sokka, which it was my great to God. See my guy.
Great to see Sokka.
So good to see him. He had a little glow up. So proud of you, Sokka. Sokka delivers the guilty verdict and uses the example of Toph's discovery of metal bending and, Sparky Sparky Boom Man.
Man.
A.K.A. Combustion Man.
He said He was so mad serious. He was like, in my time, I've seen many different forms of bending. you know, like a guy that used to firebend out of his mind. And I was like, you mean Sparky Boom Man? Come on. You got a councilman. I forgot your nicknames. Come on.
So he uses those as examples of new types and unique bending. And they essentially deduce that Yukon has figured out how to blood bend outside of the full moon. In this moment, Yukon retaliates by blood bending Sokka and Toph. He takes the keys of his handcuffs from Toph, knocks Aang out before trying to escape. Basically, we see how powerful he is. He's able to bloodbend the entire courtroom. Mm-hmm. He heads outside, and Aang enters the Avatar state in pursuit of him, and he whoops that ass. You're not going to be Aang in the Avatar state. Let's just be...
I just needed Aang to do one thing for me. When he's on the air scooter, I need him to get a little less Oberyn in his life. Like, he was, like, on the air scooter just circling the spot after he wrecked him. And I'm like, dude, can you just end this guy already? Because he's going to bloodbend you again. And if sure enough, he does. And then he has to go back into the Avatar state to, like, get out of it and then do what he does. I was just like, man, come on, Aang. Finish him. You know what I mean?
So when he finally captures Yukon, Aang does something that he's only done once before, which mm-hmm. is he takes his bending.
So I got one thing to say before we go into the next portion of this is, once again, justice for Katara. This Katara erasure is getting... I know that she is in this series, but how in a flashback about a trial about bloodbending, of which she is the only other person that we know that does this that well, is she nowhere to be found in dealing with the situation? Like, why would she not have been in that courtroom? Why would she not have been a witness? Why would she not have been... Like, she is the only other person that we know that can do this.
And she's apparently the reason that bloodbending was outlawed.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I'm not sure. I think Katara's role in this show tends to be healer and grandmother. And, you know, I got feelings about that. But
yeah, but not even just in Republic City. I'm talking about in the... Okay, if they don't want to have her, she's like, I'm done with Republic City. I'm back in the Southern Water Tribe. Okay, cool. But, like, in the trial itself, when they're all young and in their 40s and they're, like, there... Like, Katara should be front and center in this fight, right? Like, wouldn't it stand the reason that Aang would lean on her expertise around bloodbending and so would Toph and so would Sokka to bring down one of the people who they believe is bloodbending? So it just made me, I don't know whether that's going to be fleshed out somewhere down the line, but I had to shout that out because I was on this watch. I was like, wait, where is Katara right now on that trial?
So I think what we should do here is we should promise to talk about Katara and Aang's relationship next season, because I think there's a lot to unpack about them, and I want to give it justice without spoiling.
Sure.
So I hear you. You're entirely right. I want to give it some space so that we can talk, have a real conversation about what I think some of it's speculation, right? About what I think their relationship really turned out to be like.
So what we're going to say, we're going to pin in it just because we don't want to spoil you guys while you're listening. And we haven't gotten to that part in the Korra storyline where this will become, where there's more clear. But that just stood out for me as far as bloodbending. But we can move on. I agree.
Yeah,
I don't think we should
totally.
Go any further than that. Yeah,
I think you're dead on there. I think it is a standout, but I think it's part of a larger conversation. Justice for Zutara. Anyway.
Oh, no. I need my kids. I need my airbending kids. But go ahead.
Whatever. Justice for Zutara. And so back at City Hall, Team Avatar confronts Tarlok, and his assistant snitches and reveals that he's a bloodbender. Good for her. Sometimes snitching is okay.
You know what? I loved her in this moment. It was great. It was super great.
She was feeling very emboldened. Like, okay, the jig is up. I'm going to tell. Like, she was definitely stepping up in this moment.
Yeah.
So Tarlok uses bloodbending to subdue them and escapes. When he returns to Korra, she tells him that she knows that he is Yakone's son. As he goes upstairs, he's confronted by the Equalus, led by Amon. Tarlok bloodbends the Equalus, but it's not as effective against Amon. And Amon gets close to him and takes his bending. Amon orders his men to knock Korra out before they remove her from the metal jail. And they attempt to use an electric current, but Korra is very smart. She uses fabric to hold herself up while the box is being shocked. So she's not affected by the current. And then she bends her way out to escape. Amon chases her, but she manages to get away using her water bending and finds Naga in the woods. Thank God Naga is okay.
Yes.
Team Avatar finds them and reunites with Korra. Mako's a little too attentive here, and Asami takes notice.
As she should. It's just a little too much. This guy's a little too handsy, a little too like, hey, I'm so happy that you're all right. He picks her up, walks her to the thing. You're safe.
He damn near kissed her forehead. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Pushed her guardian out of the way. He pushed Tenzin out the way, like, give her space. Like, oh my God. You give her space, bro. You do that. So turning the tides, the next episode, when Mako watches over Korra's recovery, it's becoming clear to Asami that his feelings for her go beyond friendship. Tenzin comforts his kids and lets them know that everything's going to be okay. At dinner, a recovering Korra, she's getting her appetite back, you know, Korra's coming back.
Yo, she tore up that food.
Man.
Tore it up.
I mean, good for her. In fairness, she was in the wilderness. She was on the back of Naga. She was in. She
I don't
was
think she
electrocuted.
Got any food when she was with Tarlok. Yeah, she's probably exactly. Starving.
Exactly. So I feel her. And Korra tells everyone that Tarlok is Yakone's son, and that Amon captured him and took his bending. Tenzin tells them that, oh man, he's concerned about this because it means Amon's getting a little bit more bold, which could indicate that he is going into the end game.
I'm sorry, but I really couldn't watch this without, you know, hearing Benedict Cumberbatch's voice. We're in the end game now.
Like, I swear I thought the same thing. I was just like, oh my gosh.
I was just like, I can't separate Endgame from that movie. Anyway, I'm a big MCU fan, so that's...
Yeah,
that's
no, it. I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I thought it the whole time. And in fact, later on, there's even an episode called Endgame, right? So it's like, whoa, wait a second. So yeah, no. I mean, obviously this predates that movie, but it's still interesting. It did make me think about it too. So later in the kitchen, Asami confronts Mako about his kiss he shared with Korra, and ask him to be honest about his feelings. Pemba, like, you know, Homer Simpson's back into the bushes in this moment. They were in the middle of talking. She's having contractions. She's like, I'm going to let you two finish, and I'm just going to leave this kitchen. Tenzin heads to meet with the council and leaves Lin behind to watch over Pemba and the kids. Lin immediately gets stuck with Milo, who has to poop badly. Like, really badly, to the point that she metal bends and holds him out far enough to not to look at it. Oh, man. I feel like Milo's a little too old to still be pooping in his diapers.
I just think, I don't think he was saying that he has to poop in his diapers. I think he was saying he needs to get to the restroom quickly. But I just love that as soon as Lin learned that her formal rival for Tenzin was going to be the one to stay, she's like, take this child out of my hands.
Yeah. Yeah, Pema was good. Pema was good with that. She was like, "Here, Lin, take the baby. I'm glad you're staying."
I think Lin thought she was going to be more like security, not babysitter.
Yeah. Oh man. So as one of the council members is preparing to leave for the meeting that Tenzin is leaving for, she's attacked in her home by Equalist. As her very inattentive husband looks through a newspaper, like, yes, dear. Okay, dear. Not really, dear. Dear? Is that you, dear? Oh, that's great. When Tenzin arrives at City Hall, some Equalists disguised as construction workers attack him. Apparently, He is the only member of the council who has not been captured, leaving him as the de facto leader of Republic City, just as the Equalists begin to attack. Shout out to our fans. After we didn't drop our episode with this epic, it's a tragic day indeed. Oh, man, that is great. That made me laugh very much. And then also watching this episode again, I was just like, oh, my gosh, this is great. So Tenzin gets to command to the command center and learns that the police are overwhelmed by the attack. And he reached out to a general of the United Forces. Just before the power is cut, he wants to send a message. And, you know, then a dangerous gas starts to infiltrate the vents. Tenzin creates an air bubble to evacuate everyone, but the Equalists are waiting for them outside. Tenzin battles with the mega tanks, but he is injured and passes out. Team Avatar arrives, aided by Asami's incredible driving, and just in time to save Tenzin. In an airship, Hiroshi Sato watches his daughter save the day. He tells Amon how angry he is to see his daughter helping these, you know, benders. And Amon promises that he will have his daughter back shortly once they complete their mission.
Ugh, whatever. I can't stand Hiroshi Sato anyway.
So lame. Like, super lame. Like.
He's just out for vengeance. Like, up to this point, at least we know, we feel, Amon has a political agenda. Yeah. Hiroshi Sato is just out for vengeance. I can understand why, but I can't stand him.
I mean, he's number three on the list, right? There is Randall Tarley, absolute worst fucking dad, right? Like, the worst. Then there's, like, Asriel, like, really fucking bad. And then Hiroshi Sato is right around that third spot. Like, he's right there. Like, he's not that far off. He's just, yeah. I mean, he's on the Mount Rushmore, for sure. He's right there, of the shows that we've covered. So an airship lands on Air Temple Island, and Lin tries to keep everyone calm, but Pima screams out, and Lin's like, yo, calm down, I just told you to stay calm, but she's having a freaking baby, okay? She's ready to go into labor. It's happening.
And Milo speaks for all of us, because he's like, no, baby, not now.
I love that kid. Oh my gosh, I love him so much.
I had the exact same thought. I was like, listen, baby, try to be a team player here.
Like, this is not the moment, right?
Chill out for a moment.
Oh man, we know this one's gonna be a fighter, right? Like, he's like trying to come out in the midst of the battle, like, let's go, I'm ready. So the guards are no match for the Equalists, and Lin is almost taken down, but apparently the Equalists are no match for Tenzin and Pema's kids. Chinora, Milo, and Iki wipe the floor with them. Like,
easily. Without breaking a sweat. Easily.
It's so good to watch. And Chinora's like, hey, get your hands off my dad's ex-girlfriend. Like, the whole thing. Like, she's not having it. And the thing that I thought about when I was watching this is, you know, they don't have a bunch of experience fighting against airbenders. This is the only airbending family in all of the world right now, right? It's like Tenzin and the kids. And So, like, this is a reason why I think it could catch them off guard, where the kids could really take them out, because no experience defending against that.
And also they're kids. So, like, I think that was the advantage, right? They weren't expecting resistance from the kids.
No.
But you love to see it. It's great.
You do. You really, really do. By the time Tenzin arrives, the Equalists have been arrested, and Pima introduces him to their new son, Rohan. Korra interrupts the touching family moment to let them know that there are more ships arriving. Dang, Korra. But she's right. There are. And Tenzin says that he has to remove his family from the city, and Lin volunteers to go with them to protect them. He tells her that she doesn't have to, but I think, like, she's right in this moment. She basically says, you guys are the only airbenders. You're the last airbenders left. Like, you are so valuable. We have to make sure that you get out of here, right, safely. Mm-hmm. So he tells Korra and the others to hide. And Korra says, oh, what you're telling me is, basically she says to him, she's not going to give up. And Tenzin says to her, I'm not asking you to give up. And then she realizes what he's asking her to be is to be patient. until the United forces arrive. And he lets her know that he sees that she's growing, that she could deduce, like, that, hey, it's time to just be patient in this moment until we have the numbers. The Equalists arrive moments later, and guards from the Order of the White Lotus hold them off while Korra and the team escape on Naga. Undetected in the water, she creates an air, you know, little, like, water bubble as they, you know, go underneath, and Naga swims them to safety. Airships pursue Tenzin and others on Ugi. And Lin says, you know what? I'm tired of this. I'm about to leap off and do what I do, metal bending style, just like my mom. I'm rocking like Toph.
Yeah, she leaps it was great to see. I loved it. It reminded me of the finale of Atla when Suki, Sokka, and Toph are just messing up the airships. You love to 100%. See that too.
Yeah, 100%. And Lin had even perfected it. She was running and ripping it up as she was running. It was great. It was so, so good. And so that's what she's doing. She starts ripping up the airship. And she is eventually stopped and captured. But she let, you know, Pema, Tenzin, and the kids know to just keep going. Like, even if she got captured, so that they would remain safe. Lin is taken to Amon, who he asks, you know, where the Avatar is. She's obviously not giving up any info. You know, she's built like that. And he strips her of her bending because she refuses to tell him anything.
That's sad. The final scene, probably would have stripped her of her bending regardless, because that's his whole thing. But
agreed. He's all about the showing he can pull people's get rid of people's bending. It's wild. In the final scene, a soldier tells General Iroh. What? But not
a very young General Iroh.
A very young General Iroh.
I wonder who he could be.
I mean,
he sounds a little bit like the previous Fire Lord.
Yeah, he sounds a lot like that guy. He even has a little bit of his swag. He looks a little like him as he stands at the top of the front of an airship. Pretty interesting. General Iroh says that the Avatar, basically the soldier tells General Iroh that the Avatar has been in touch and says that Amon has taken the city. He says to respond, he'll be arriving to the city in 3 days.
Oh, what an episode. I loved
it. What an episode.
Episode 11, Skeletons in the Closet. Amon's Republic City is pretty different from the Republic City we know. Bending is illegal. The Equalists are celebrating their victory. They have a big rally, and Hiroshi Sato tells the crowd that Amon has the Avatar on the run, and they won't let the city be taken back by the United Forces.
Hiroshi Sato's garbage ass giving the keynote address. Yep, there it is.
Korra, Asami, Bolin, and Mako have found refuge in an underground tent city. You know, they met up with the gentleman that Korra shared fish with in episode one.
He's a good dude. I like him.
Yeah, I like him. He's a good dude. Mako tells Korra how brave and selfless she is. And, you know, they have a little moment. But rather than embracing the moment, Korra says, oh, okay, I got to go to sleep.
Yeah, because she's not trying to play this game, you know.
Like, Asami is literally in the same room. Like, yes. This is a problem. Anyway.
And he kind of leans in like he's thinking this is going to be like a kiss or something, and kind of like moves towards her. And she's like, all right, yeah, I'm going to sleep. Sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's playing games of her emotions at this point. His girlfriend is steps away. Like, it's this guy. So the Equalists have rounded up most of the city's benders, and one by one, Amon is stripping them of their bending. The next morning, the United Forces arrive, but there's no resistance, no tanks, no airships, nothing, because it's a trap. They use bombs to destroy all the ships that had been placed in the harbor over, you know, before. They're underwater. It reminded me a little bit of the Battle of Blackwater, I'm not gonna lie.
Yes, it does. And it's like so still. Like the movie Pearl Harbor, like, because you're like sitting there and it's like they've got these brand new like airplanes, and even Bolin's like, when does this guy have time to make new shit? Like, this is crazy. Like,
yeah, it's insane. Like, the Hiroshi's been out of commission for like 24 hours or whatever, but he had time to design a whole new aircraft.
Yeah.
Korra jumps into the water, and in an attempt to help, but fighter jets arrive. They drop bombs from above, and the United Forces strike back, but they're quickly overwhelmed. Like, the fire bending is no match for, and you know, they have some earthbenders too. They're no match for these aircrafts. Mm-hmm. Korra has to save Iroh when a bomb destroys his ship and he falls into the water. Back in the Tent City, Iroh sends a warning to Commander Bumi, who is leading their reinforcements. That's Tenzin's brother. To retreat to Red Sand Island until they receive an all-clear message.
Shout out to Bumi, the original, that Aang kept it like that. Aang and Katara like named their son after him. That's awesome.
It is really nice. In order to clear the way for the United Forces backup, they have to figure out how to ground the fleet of aircrafts. Korra decides that she's going to stay behind to face Amon. Mako agrees to stay with her. But Bolin, Asami, and Iroh take Naga into the mountains, and Korra and Mako head over to Air Temple Island disguised as Equalus.
Yeah, and I think it's appropriate for anyone who doesn't know. I mean, if you don't know, I mean, do you even Atla? But I'm just saying, like, Iroh is Zuko's grandson. I think it's appropriate to throw that out there right now. All right. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, shout out to all these names coming back. Bumi, Iroh. Like, it's super dope. I'm here for it. I'm also here for, I won't say anymore, but I do like Korra saving Iroh. And, you know, that I was hoping that would go a little further. I'm just saying.
I was really hoping that was going to be her new love interest. Like, yeah. Anyway.
Yes.
Iroh. Yes. We like General Iroh. He's a good character. So when Mako and Korra arrive at Air Temple Island, they go into the temple and they go up to hide in the attic. Mm-hmm. There they find Tarlok. Tarlok tells them critical information. He reveals mm-hmm. that Amon is his brother. Mm. Amon is from the Northern Water Tribe, just like him, and is a waterbender and a bloodbender. Yakon escaped from prison and changed his appearance and went to the Northern Water Tribe, where he met a woman and married and had two sons, Noatak and Tarlok. Mm. As the boys grew, he trained them as waterbenders, and Yakon became increasingly cruel to them. He took the boys on a trip and told them his identity and that he wanted them to become bloodbenders and destroy the Avatar. He trained them every full moon to bloodbend, and eventually he taught them to bloodbend without the full moon. Tarlok hated it. It made him really uncomfortable. They were using animals mostly, and he just couldn't stand it. But Noatak embraced it and became a prodigy. Over the years, Noatak became more and more cold and detached. And one day, Yakon made the boys bloodbend each other. Tarlok refused. After Noatak had bloodbended him, he said he never wanted to bloodbend again because of how horrible it felt. Yakon threatened him, but Noatak stepped in between them and bloodbended his father. Mm. He tells Tarlok that he wants to run away forever, but Tarlok refuses to leave their mother, and Noatak leaves alone. Yakon stopped training Tarlok after that, and he passed away a few years later, and their mother was just never the same after Noatak left. Tarlok tells Korra and Mako that when Amon took his bending, the sensation that he felt was the same as the one that he felt when Noatak bloodbended him, which is how he knew that it was his brother. Korra and Mako come up with a plan. Now they have the tool they need to derail Amon. They will reveal that he's actually a bender at the big rally that the Equalists are planning that evening.
Yeah, it's man, what a tough story, right?
Yeah, like, it's It's really a hard. I mean, as you know, when we were talking about this a little bit beforehand, I had mentioned to you that Cora sums it up perfectly. This is the saddest story. Mm-hmm. What a heartbreaking mm-hmm. story. The whole family just fell apart because of Yacone's cruelty. Mm. I wondered about their mother, you know, like I felt really bad for her because she didn't know about the bloodbending. She didn't know who her husband was. One of her children went missing. It's really devastating. And, you know, we should say at this point that we're going to talk about the next episode. And it gets even more heavy. There, you know, at this point, there's some self-harm that is mentioned. And so if, you know, that makes you uncomfortable or you feel like you're not in a good space to hear it now, I would recommend that at this point you don't go any further listening. But we're going to cover the end of the story, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good call out. And the next episode is called Endgame. And, you know, before we go into Endgame, I will say this. Northern Water Tribe, not a great track record when
to like, I really power. Don't like the Northern Water Tribe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
UA's it. Like, UA's it. Like, who else we got?
I mean, UA's dad was cool, right?
Yeah. I got UA, UA's dad, Paku, and Grand Graham.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's it. That's what I got. Outside of that, I'm just like, I mean, even the guy who was trying to date UA, that Sokka was like, he was trash. You know what I mean? Like,
and I mean, Paku was kind of trash until Katara sent him by straight.
A 14-year-old. Yeah. Yeah. So the 14-year-old like humbled him. Like, it was like, oh, okay, cool. Anyway. All right. So Endgame. Iroh, Bolin, and Asami arrive at the secret airstrip and quickly find out that it's been protected by an electrical force field. Like, they find out the hard way. Like, oh, wait, there's all these beams, but there's no, like, fence. Like, why is there no... electrocution. Oh, man. The Equalist rally at the arena begins, and Amon tells his lie again about how a firebender took down his family, and Korra immediately heckles him and calls him out. That's a lie, right? Korra's like, you're lying. And calls him by his government name. I mean, like, his whole government. Like, it's crazy. And everybody's like, who the hell is that?
She's like, and, Noah Talk.
Hey, Noah Talk. All right? Like, you're not Amon. Cut it out. She tells the crowd that Amon is actually a bender. And he's a bloodbender. And Amon takes off his mask to show them a Zuko-like scar.
It's a terrible attempt at a Zuko-like scar.
A terrible attempt at that. Exactly. It's not even, you know, our guy Zuko had legitimately been through the fire. You know what I mean? Like, so, unfortunately, because I, you know, I think if I'm being honest, I think Iroh, his grandson, like, actually, that's a lot how Zuko would have looked like back in the day, right? Like, mm-hmm, without his mm-hmm. dad being the worst. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I forgot on that list of terrible freaking dads, Ozai. Wait a minute, mm-hmm. how could I forget him? So maybe Ozai knocks him down, knocks Hiroshi Sato
Listen,
down.
Listen, you also have to include Azulon in there. I mean, they don't have a great track record with fatherhood over in the royal family.
Yeah, it's very true. It's super true. I mean, the best fatherly figures we got in here in Atlas so far, Tenzin and Hakoda, right?
And Iroh.
Iroh, yep, and Iroh, yep.
Iroh yep, so Senior, there we go. Yeah.
Iroh Senior. So, Amon tells Korra that, wait, not so fast. You may not want to leave yet. You're about to see the main attraction. And reveals that he's actually captured Tenzin and his family. And she's mortified because she thought they got away. And she doesn't know, you know, she's like, man, I'm not leaving them. I got to go save them. And the others have been captured as well over at the airstrip, and they're in a jail. And Hiroshi tells them that he intercepted the message to Bumi and knows exactly where the rest of the fleet is, and he's going to take out the fleet. So, man, this is going badly. This is not the way that they drew this up. And, man, you really miss Sokka in these moments when you need a good plan, right? Like, you know? Oh, man. So, just then, Naga arrives with Pabu and breaks out the team that is Asami, Iroh, and Bolin out of jail. And goes and Asami gets into one of the mega tanks while Iroh takes on an aircraft. Before Amon can take the bending from Tenzin and his family, Korra and Mako attack and manage to free Tenzin and the kids. They escape through the hallway of the arena, but Amon follows. Amon finds Korra by bloodbending her and then does the same to Mako when he tries to save her. Amon finally makes a big speech, the whole thing, and he takes Korra's bending from her while Mako is immobilized on the floor. Tough moment.
The bending is gone. I didn't think this was going to happen. I was shocked.
Me too. Meanwhile, Iroh pursues the aircraft and destroys a few before leaping from his own. Like other members of his family, he can use his firebending to propel himself through the air. I wonder if he got those lessons from his, you know, Auntie Azula.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if she was like, hey, you know what? Let me show you how to do this.
I mean, it is a family trait, though. His grandfather was good at it, too. So
yeah,
I'm assuming that he's never met his auntie.
I mean, maybe they pieced it out over the years. Maybe she calmed
down in her
older. Yeah, we
don't know, right? We don't know, but... it's certainly a skill that this family has.
Yeah. Well, I've never really seen. Did we really see Zuzu pull it off?
Huh. I feel like we did see him do some of it when he was fighting Aang at that monastery.
Ah, good call.
Yeah, I feel like, and also that fight that him, Azula, and Team Avatar and Iroh have. I can't remember the title of the episode. I need to see the episode again in my current rewatch of Atla. Mm-hmm. I'm not up to that episode yet, but I think Azula is probably the most well-known for it in Ozai.
I dig it. Yeah, I love it. So anyway, he does this. He flies, right, using firebending, and he ends up crashing an aircraft into a statue that had an Amon mask put over Aang. And the mask comes down. We see Aang's face revealed as he's hanging from the statue. And he says, thank you for protecting me, Aang, for watching over me. What a good moment. Wow. It's good stuff. Especially hearing how much he sounds like Zuko. It's like really good stuff when he was young. So Asami begins destroying the aircraft with the mega tanks until her father comes to confront her. The two of them battle in the tanks and he almost kills her. And Bolin says that we all feel you're the worst dad, like, ever. Like, God, you're terrible. And before he's like, you know, Bolin comes in and saves the day. And before he escapes, Asami captures her dad. Amon's lieutenant confronts him now back where, you know, he's just taking Korra's bending. And he's like, you know, the Avatar was telling the truth. You are a bender. I just saw you bloodbend them. And, you know, basically Amon deals with him quickly, gets rid of him. You've served me well, and pushes him to the side. Mako attempts to save Korra by somehow firebending as he was about to take his bending. Really? This is like one of Mako's shining moments. Like one of the moments
he gets
like
to jump on him. It's awesome.
Yeah, it was so good. Like, this is a time we can give him his flowers, okay? Like, good job, Mako, because we needed that. Korra unlocks her airbending as Amon gets Mako in the hallway, and Amon is shocked. He's like, no way. How is that possible? And she knocks Amon into the water where his scar washes off. Now Amon, really pissed off, lets down his guys and waterbends his way back to the surface of the water and shows that, you know, he is able to bend. And everybody's like, wow, he's a bender.
Yeah, the crowd really goes quickly through emotions here. First, when Korra knocks him into the water, they're like, the Avatar is evil. And then when he waterbends his way out of the water, they realize that he lied, that he is a bender himself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild to see the pendulum swing that quickly. It's wild. So he also waterbends himself back to Air Temple Island and reunites with his brother. He basically tells him, "Let's escape. Let's get out of here. Let's do what we should have done years ago, when I asked you to run away with me after I bloodbended our dad." And so Tarlok goes along. He says, "Yeah, let's go." And they get on a boat, and on a boat escaping Republic City, Tarlok uses one of the Equalist gloves and blows up the ship, killing himself and his brother. Yeah. Back now in the Southern Water Tribe, do we pour one out for Tarlok?
I think we can pour one out for both of them.
Yeah.
I think we can pour one out for Tarlok and for Amon. They both were power hungry, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it didn't have to be this way for them. You know, their father's abuse created this in them. So
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. I feel like, you know, they just, and they even mentioned that, like Tarlok says, man, our dad did this to us. You know what I mean? Set us both on a path that eventually we would meet up in this way. And man, yeah, I pour one out for both those guys. It was tough existence. They hurt a lot of people, but they also were very badly wounded in their past. So back in the Southern Water Tribe, most of Team Avatar is devastated as they wait for Katara to try to heal Korra. Katara tells them that Korra's connection to the other elements has been severed. Disappointed, Korra walks away, and Mako follows her and tells her that he loves her. But she's really not in the space to talk about that right now. She's like, man, I need some time. And she jumps on Naga and runs away. Alone, she begins to sob. And she's approached. And it looks like it could be Tenzin, but it's not. It's Aang. Aang tells her that she finally has connected to her spiritual self and that she summoned him to there to talk to her. And when we hit our lowest point, he says, we are sometimes open to our greatest change. Korra sees all of her past lives before her, and Aang touches her head and restores her bending. She immediately goes into the Avatar state. Just as a flex, just because, mm-hmm. you know, I
she,
can.
Because she can. Why it? Not? Like, just go into the Avatar state.
Yeah. Mako's kind of there. Like, I mean, can you imagine walking up on, like, your the person that you're interested in, and they're just like, they just, like, had no bending. You think you're coming to comfort them, and now they're bending all the elements. Like, fall back. Fall back, my guy. Like, and there, they share a moment. She turns to him, and she says, I love you too. And they kiss. Korra is able to restore the bending of others now, and so she restores Lin's bending, which is great, because I was mm-hmm. gonna be really sad if that kept up. And the season ends with Tenzin telling Korra he's proud of her and calls her Avatar Korra. So she's completed her mission. Wow.
I love
it. What a run. What a first season.
Yeah, I really love the finale of this first season. I had trouble with some of the episodes, but I really enjoyed the way that the season ended. It was really good. I got emotional when Korra got emotional. When her bending was gone, I was devastated for her. Mm-hmm. It was just, there was a lot. I like the way they ended it, though. It was very good.
Yeah, I agree. I really love the ending. I love seeing all the avatars. I love that, you know, connecting to her spiritual self brought the bending back. It tells us something like, you know, like what Amon was trying to do was kind of like not possible to take away her bending ultimately once she connected to her spiritual self. Because, like, I mean, Aang is not in a body. He's just in the spiritual realm, right, in the spiritual world. So he's like, you know, somehow able to bring it back to her. So that's pretty cool. I just loved it. I loved the whole thing. I love that she, you know, we start with her kind of more physically, like, gifted than anything. And we see her go through this whole journey of relationships and finding herself and, you know, trusting others and trusting her and working with a team and becoming part of a team to then find her, like, you know, really, really lose everything, like lose all of her strength to find it, mm-hmm. you know, like lost it all, like everything to be able to find the element she was in search of mastery of, you know? So it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. What do we think about Tenzin and Pema's kids?
They killed it. I mean, they're just so... They're so great when they fight the Equalists. Yeah. They sold me. They're funny. They add a lot of levity. I think Tenzin is, like, just a breakout star from the show. Like, he is both funny, but he also provides that, like, fatherly influence that mm-hmm. Korra needs. He's not perfect. He's stubborn. He is, like, extremely stuck in traditional ways, but he loves Korra. He has a good moral center, and his kids are heroic. You know, they have that, like, heroic, you know, inclination to them. They just know when to step up, and I like them. I'm still Zutara, but yes, the kids are a good reason to support the Aang and Katara union.
See, this is what I've been in search of. We've had this conversation many, many times, and I know that some people are more Zutara as yourself, but I remember, like, you've watched this series multiple times, but before you actually watched the series, I remember saying to you, no, just trust me, like, that's important, like, cause at the end of Atla, you were like, no, I'm not here for it, I wanted Zutara, and I just think, like, for me, that's where I land, like, yes, there's probably benefits either way, but I really love the kids. I really do. Like, I love the airbending kids. Like, they're absolutely the best. And yeah, I just think that they're brave, they're fun, they're lighthearted, and it only gets better with time. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Only gets better.
Mm-hmm.
It's really powerful too that they're the only airbenders in the world, you know?
When Amon threatened them, I was stressed. Like, very, very stressed. You know, because at that point we don't know that Korra is going to be able to restore bending. So you're having this moment where you're like, oh no, we're at a point again where the only airbenders may not be airbenders anymore. And what happens to their legacy?
Yeah, agree. I totally agree. And yeah, I enjoy the fact that Lin, like, it almost flashed us back seeing them on Ugi flying away and Lin being there. It almost made you feel like, you know, it was Toph and Aang in a way
mm-hmm.
because, you know, obviously it's their next generation and they're related to them. But to see Lin's sense of duty of like, no, like, I know how hard it was for there to be any more airbenders in the world. Like, we can't allow you guys to be hurt. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
that's connected to what they mm-hmm. all know was the struggle, you know, to a whole tribe of people being wiped out in this world, you know?
Yeah. And it's just like kind of lucky, right? That Tenzin was born an airbender. He could have been born with no bending ability, or he could have been born a waterbender. So his family is really important in that way, because you don't know if you're going to have that kind of luck that again.
Exactly. Exactly. As they try to rebuild it. And then, man, Naga and Pabu really come through.
Mm-hmm. I know who could take some notes.
What'd you say?
I know who needs to take some notes.
Who's that?
Pan from his Dark Material. Okay. This is how you're useful. Okay. You know, I love Pan, but Pan does not always turn into the thing that you need him to turn into in the moment.
No.
Naga and Pabu don't even have the ability to turn into anything else, but they know when they're needed. They have the instincts.
Yeah, it's true. I do want to give Pan a little credit, though, in Chittagatsi, because he bossed up in Chittagatsi. He, like, turned into some things that he was like, okay, that's right on time. That's it. But there's some, season one, Pan was just like, and I was just like, what are you turning into? Why are you doing that? Especially the boat scene. You know how I feel about the boat scene. It's so irritated. Like, I just don't understand. Like, what? Why aren't you turning into something more powerful than what you did? Yeah, I'm with you. I think he could take some lessons. Definitely take some lessons. Pabu, like, chewing through the ropes. Naga coming through, breaking him out of jail. They had a great run in these episodes. Like, great run. Mm-hmm.
They're super useful, right? And Pabu, no disrespect to my fave, Momo, but Pabu seems to understand more than Momo really ever could. So yes. he's you know, Bolin has trained him, and he comes in a clutch in moments that are, it's important to have like a small animal. So yeah, he's great. They're both great.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's a good, it's kind of a good kind of like counter to see the animals be so active to like what we see with technology in this world. Mm-hmm. Like, right. Like to see like, hey, okay, this is a whole other portion of that. But like, man, Benders are pretty overwhelmed by technology. There's like a real balancing that's happening with benders and the non-benders based on like the technological advancements, and you really see it, you know, in Avatar Last Airbender. There was like, you know, it wasn't as prevalent, like benders were the most powerful, but now it's starting to equal out a little bit.
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about the way that technology played a role in Avatar is that many times, because the technology was powered by bending, if you distracted or, you know, immobilized the benders who were controlling the the technology, you could overcome the technology. But now that's not really the case. Like, they got really overwhelmed quickly with the aircrafts. Because benders are not the most technologically interested or savvy, they're frequently surprised in Korra by what the technology can do. So Sato got the jump on them a couple times. He got the jump on them with the gloves that send the electric shock, the chi blocking gloves. He also got the jump on them with the airships. So I think that this has been interesting to watch, because one of the things that gave the benders the advantage in Avatar was that the technology essentially also needed bending. But now anyone can sort of wield technology in a way that makes bending not necessarily irrelevant, but a little bit less powerful. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it was used in some terrible ways in this season, but it's definitely an interesting development. And I thought it was fascinating how they rolled it out.
Especially in the world moving forward. I agree. So what do you think the White Lotus has to teach us this time around in these four episodes?
So I was really taken by Aang's conversation with Korra at the end. You know, when we hit our lowest point, we are open to the greatest change. And it reminded me of an article that I frequently read and reread when I'm having, when I'm struggling, and I send to my friends all the time when they're struggling. I just wanted to kind of introduce this concept. So the title of the article is "Why Lying Broken in a Pile on Your Bedroom Floor is a Good Idea." Mm. And I think most of us can think of times when we were lying broken, whether in our bed or on the floor, and it feels like the worst place you can possibly be. This article was published in 2011 by Elephant Journal, which is a spiritual website, and it was written by a woman named Julie Peters. So Peters writes about a Hindu goddess, the goddess of Never Not Broken, whose power comes from being pulled apart and put back together. And I just want to quote from this article because I think it really fits with what Aang was telling Korra. And I think it's so, so true of just the experience of losing, you know, I'm going to say with quotes, everything. The thing about going through a sudden or scary or sad transition like a breakup is one of the things you lose in your future. your expectations of what the story of your life so far was going to become. When you lose that partner or that job or that person, your future dissolves in front of you. But you look, this goddess whose name is, I'm going to butcher her name a little bit, and I apologize for that, but it's Akhilanda, says, now you have to make a choice. In pieces, in a pile on the floor, with no idea of how to go forward, your expectations of the future are meaningless. Your stories about the past do not apply. You are in flux. You are changing. You are flowing in a new way. And this is an incredible opportunity to become new again, to choose how you want to put yourself back together. Confusion can be an incredible teacher. How could you ever learn if you already had it all figured out? So I've read this article many, many times. And I think that in reflecting in the darkest moments of my life, that it is true that you, when you are stripped of all the things that you thought you had, or you are stripped of the future that you imagined for yourself, and in this moment, Korra is stripped of essentially being the Avatar, someone that she has known herself to be since she was a very small child. Our introduction to Korra is her whole identity is wrapped up in being the Avatar. I'm the Avatar and you have to deal with it. Mm. While Korra is on this cliff, she's alone. She's alone by herself. There's no friends to help her. There's no teacher. There's nothing. She's just by herself. And in that moment, her truest self comes through and she connects with her spirituality. And that is how she's able to connect with Aang. And she decides how to proceed from there. I don't think what this is telling us is that when you're at your lowest point, you're always your truest self. I think there are people who at their lowest point, it brings out the worst in them. And I think that we need to leave space for that as well. But for those of us who get to a low point, and we feel like we can decide, we can move forward, we're not completely incapacitated by whatever terrible experience we've just had, it is a moment that when we look back, we can say, this is the moment that I decided to try something new. This is the moment that I decided that I was going to go back to something I had given up because it, you know, I got distracted. I'm going to try a new career. I'm going to, you know, be by myself for a while. I'm going to write that story that I never put down on the page. I'm going to spend more time with friends and family. And so I think that this moment for Korra, where she's stripped of her identity, basically, is something that we can all take from.
Wow. Great stuff. Great, great stuff. Yeah, no, I agree. It reminds me of something I've read. There was a Buddhist website I was reading that spoke about it, saying a broken heart is an open heart, you know, mm-hmm. and that idea of, like, you know, what you just said about, like, you know, a chance to form something new, to redecide how we're going to, you know, when we're in that puddle on the floor and things are not quite what we thought they were. We're in our, in, you know, maybe we're, you know, broken to pieces, how to rebuild and redecide where we're going to go. I love that. I love that. That's a great takeaway. The White Lotus. Good stuff. The other thing that really stands out is in this run of episodes is around trauma. The story of Yacone, Noatak, and Tarlok and their mom is a dark one and ends in a real tragic way. But it tells us an important story about the fallout of trauma and suffering. Noatak and Tarlok, they basically were raised by the same parents, and they tried to have different, and they both have different approaches to life. Noatak became the leader of a movement he believed in and used his talents for bending to get revenge on benders, right? Whatever feelings he had there that were unchecked, like, that's what he decided to put his energies into. He did that rather than to make peace with them. Tarlok tried to wield his governmental power by oppressing non-benders. Both of these men suffered cruelly at the hands of their father, and despite hating him, neither of them could escape Yacone's legacy. The trauma he inflicted on them impacted them so deeply that they became exactly like the man they loathed. Experiencing trauma does not make us bad people, but it does affect us in many different ways. And that portion reminds me also of something. I've read this paper about something called negative love syndrome, about how a lot of times the trauma we experience as kids, you know, will kind of like, we'll either try to be nothing like our parents and wind up saying, hey, like, look, I'm nothing like you. Look what you made me do. Now will you love me? Or we'll be just like our parents and be like, look, my life is like crappy and it's all because of you. Like, now will you love me? And it's really in seeking out the parental love. And that is what I see a lot in Noah Talk and Tarluk. I really do see this idea of like, they wanted their love of their father. And even though they didn't like the man, every kid wants the love of their parents in some way. And so this was kind of them living out that story that he begun trying to get that love. And it just was done in ways that were misguided. And so that's why we could pour, you know, something out for both of them, because honestly, it was their trauma that was speaking through them more than it was them and who they were authentically.
Right. I mean, I think that Noah Talk, aka Amon, actually had a point here. Mm-hmm. There is an imbalance between the benders and non-benders, and we've seen that the benders, in part because they were replaced in some ways by technology, had been, some of them had been terrorizing the city with these various criminal gangs, right? Mm-hmm. So we see that this is an unfair society. It's the way he went about trying to correct that. He also went with hatred of bending. Mm-hmm. It's not the way, it's not the path forward, is to strip benders of their identity and of who, of their ability. But I can understand the deep frustrations of the benders. And it's just, I feel like if maybe he wouldn't have ever had his feelings about bending if his father hadn't been so cruel, right? So the parts of him that we also say, okay, we can understand that, may also be connected to his trauma. That said, let's say that he had come about those feelings on his own. I don't think he would have been as brutal. I don't think he would have been comfortable with collateral damage. I don't think that he would have wanted to inflict pain on benders if he hadn't had pain inflicted on him too.
I agree.
I don't have no excuse for Tarluk, except that he basically... You know, he I think that he wanted to be the hero. We said this earlier, and he didn't know what heroics looked like because he was only used to sort of the brutality of his family situation. But, you know, I think Tarluk got kind of drunk with power, which is essentially what he tells Korra, which is like he wanted to be in control.
100%. I agree. I 100% agree. But it's a classic. I mean, it's a good, you know, and this season, as we move into the next season, it, you know, it kind of brings everything to a conclusion with this theme. But these things stay with Korra throughout, you know, like she learns a different aspect of, you know, the problems of this world with each time that she encounters these different trials through the kind of like the mirror that's reflecting back to her based on the enemy she's facing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she sees a lot about herself and a lot about the society as a whole. So that's what makes it interesting. That being said, I do think that's also, as we go deeper, we'll talk about it. What makes it tough is that every season, we almost end with like whatever the conflict was is resolved and wrapped up. Some of that's more meta, but it just that's where you see a little bit difference in as we move forward, we'll talk more about like kind of like the disconnect between some of the story, you know?
So. Yeah, totally. I mean, there's no single big bad in this series. There's many societal ills and conflicts that Korra is navigating, and there's basically a different villain every time.
Yeah, and I like that. To me, like, ultimately where I land, I know that not everybody does, I like that because a lot of times she's dealing more with the society fallout than she is dealing with one person being so terrible. It's like, which is a lot of times, you know, what happens? Society impacts these people And that's why they become like the face of something that is a bigger problem than like, you know, the person being bad themselves, which I think
she has an opportunity that Aang never got, right? As Aang, Katara, and Sokka traveled through, especially the Earth Kingdom, they saw quite a bit of injustice, and not all of that injustice was related to Ozai. And certainly when they got to Ba Sing Se, you can't really blame Ozai for all of the things that were going on there. Although there was no war in Ba Sing Se.
There is no war.
Right. The war did have impact, but it wasn't the only reason for the inequities that existed.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot that they could do about some of those problems, because their number one problem was that they had to deal with the Fire Lord. And so Korra does have an opportunity to deal with some of the things that Aang and Katara and Sokka and Toph and Zuko couldn't really deal with during Atla, because she's not facing a single big bad. So yeah. I appreciate it too. Doesn't always work, you know, every season, but I do think she had more opportunity to just deal with the struggles of people in this world than Aang ever really got to.
Totally agree. And we say all that to say we are moving into book two of Korra with our next episode. The controversial book. There's lots of things that happen. But stay with us. Let's talk about this. Let's unpack what happens here in book two. It's a good one. I enjoy it. I know some of you guys enjoy it. And let's do it. We're moving on to the next book. And it's been fun so far. And we hope that you continue on this journey with us through The Legend of Korra in Republic City and the whole greater Avatar universe. Follow us, Kin Folklore Pod, Instagram, Twitter. Join our Facebook group. And definitely, definitely reach out to us on any of those mediums, including email at kinfolklore@gmail.com. We appreciate y'all, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.